think it helps us see how great God is. Unfortunately, I find a lot of brethren who are somewhat intimidated by the fossil record. That is something that belongs to the creationist in the minds of a lot of people. They are the ones that like to talk about the fossils, and that shouldn't be the case. They ought to be, and really, when you get all the facts together, are embarrassed by the fossil record. I think it speaks very eloquently and powerfully for a creator and for a judgment, and very much against the picture of evolution. We should be able to look at the fossil record and tell the difference between creation and evolution. If evolution were true, then we understand it should begin slowly and gradually develop upward. If creation is true, we should have a sudden and complex beginning. Those are two very different predictions, and we ought to be able to tell the difference. But the fossil record is certainly critical. If you're going to prove, as an evolutionist, what happened in the past and that evolution took place, how could you prove it any other way than by the fossil record? You can surmise from circumstantial evidence that something happened, but if you want to prove what did happen, this is where you have to go. S.M. Stanley of Johns Hopkins makes this point when he says it's doubtful whether, in the absence of fossils, the idea of evolution would represent anything more than an outrageous hypothesis. Now, I think that's right, and I think it is without the fossils. But remember this point. When we get through and we see that this evidence doesn't support their view, he says the fossil record, and only the fossil record, provides direct evidence of major sequential changes in the Earth's biota. So if you're going to prove it, this is where it's at. However, the kind of proof that would be provided by such evidence is not really scientific proof, as we talked about Monday evening, the kind of proof that's involved in the scientific method by observation and repeatability. John Horner is the individual that maybe some of you saw in the movie Jurassic Park, or at least represented there. He's the real-life character that the fellow digging up dinosaurs in Montana represented, but a very famous paleontologist. He wrote a book, Dinosaur Lives, and he makes this very important observation. Paleontology is a historical science. Now, that's different from physics. It's different from chemistry, where you can repeat and experiment. It is a science, he says, based on circumstantial evidence after the fact. We can never reach hard and fast conclusions. Now, if there's any proof at all, it would be here, but then when you... If you did get proof, it still wouldn't be hard and fast conclusions. It's historical evidence. He says these days it's easy to go through school for a good many years, sometimes even through college, without ever hearing that some sciences are historical or by nature inconclusive. And so we need to remember the nature of this kind of evidence. Let's think about the predictions, the contrasting predictions that are made by the two models. Evolution and creation. As we think about the beginning of what ought to be in the fossil record, if you're an evolutionist or a creationist, we understand that an evolutionist would predict a simple and gradual beginning, that they would be linked, one growing from the other, connected. On the other hand, the creationist would predict a complex beginning that would be abrupt and would not be linked together, but would be diverse, reflecting the diversity, the kind of ingenuity that would come from the hand of a creative God. Those are different. Can we look at the fossil record and see which one works better? It should be relatively easy. I think it is. As we look at the continuing record, the evolutionist will predict that there are branching similarities. One leads to another, connected, growing up as in a continuum, branching upward. and that there would be a progression. On the other hand, the evolutionist would predict some similarities because there's a common designer, and there would be similar forms for similar functions, but it would not be necessarily connected or branching, more as a designer of a mosaic would use a blue tile here where it's needed and another blue tile over here when he needs the same effect, but they wouldn't necessarily be connected. So similarities, both are predicted, both predict similarities, but not necessarily the same kind. They would be separate and distinct, and stasis, a word which simply means not progression, would be the order of the day. Now, I'll tell you that the one on the right is the one that fits the fossil record, but then I'm a creationist, and you might expect that. I think it's much more effective if the evolutionist tells you that. And that's the method that we'll be using. The quotes that we'll be looking at will be from the antagonistic witness. Now, some people have a difficult time with this concept. Some people think, well, you're being unfair. You're quoting people that don't agree with you. And we need to understand that that really is more powerful evidence. If you're in court, you have a friendly witness who testifies on your behalf and says the accused is honest and there's no reasonable motive, that'll help. But he's your friend. That's really not a whole lot of help. If, on the other hand, you get people who are antagonistic, who are testifying against their interest to acknowledge that the accused is honest, then that weighs a whole lot more and is more powerful. Friendly witness helps, but acknowledgments contrary to interest, is the way it's described judicially, are much more effective, and that's what we're going to be using. And I want us to understand that the men that we're quoting from are devout believers, but they're believers in evolution. They're men of great faith, but they have faith in evolution, so I don't want to misrepresent them. They believe the opposite of what I believe, but let's look at what they acknowledge to be true. What do they say about the beginning of the fossil record? Well, we look at National Geographic's description of that beginning bottom layer as they define it, the Cambrian layer, and it's described as an explosion of life. And the reason is you got virtually nothing before it, and when you get to it, you got virtually everything. Richard Dawkins is one we've quoted from several times. He's the one that says if you don't believe in evolution, you're just ignorant or insane or wicked. Certainly is an evolutionist. But notice the way he describes the beginning of the fossil record. We find many of them already in an advanced state of evolution. Now, it's evolution that got them there. But they're advanced. And where is that? Right at the beginning, the very first time they appear. Well, now, how do you know it's evolution that got them there? Well, that's a matter of faith, you see. It's not based on the evidence, because the evidence just shows them there and they're advanced. It is as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. Now, he believes in that evolutionary history as a matter of blind faith, but it's not there in the fossil record. Needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted the creationists. That's another way of saying it fits their predictions, it doesn't fit our predictions. And predictions are one way to compare models. And I'll plead guilty there. Yeah, that's delightful. If you're trying to look at the evidence, it fits the creationist view perfectly. It does not fit their view. Stephen Gould is one of the antagonists to the creation position, one of the better known evolutionists in the country. He says the Cambrian explosion, and again, the Cambrian is the name of that layer right at the bottom of the geologic column. This explosion occurred in a geological moment, and we have reason to think all major anatomical designs may have made their evolutionary appearance at that time. Now again, he has faith that it was an evolutionary appearance, but when they appear, boom, you got everything. Now, there's a tremendous variety of anatomy that we see in the world, but all the major anatomical designs, all the major phylum, as it's presented sometimes, are right there at the explosion at the bottom of the first layer, as they define it. Not only the phylum Chordata, now that's the group with backbones, that's supposed to be the most advanced group, not only right there at the beginning do we find the animals with backbones, but all its major divisions. Now, if I were trying to write this story, I could hardly do a better job. But this is one of the major antagonists of the creationist, acknowledging that this is what you find in the fossil record. Since the so-called Cambrian explosion, no new phylum of animals have entered the record. You got all the major anatomical designs, the highest order, Chordata, the animals with backbones, all the major divisions, and since then, nothing new. Now, how would you write it to favor one view more than the other? You couldn't make it up any better than that. We're summarizing in our sessions this evening, actually putting two lessons together, but let's go to the summary slide, and we won't have all of the quotes, but you will have them on the handout. Describing the beginning of this Cambrian layer, the evolutionists themselves say it was complex. It began suddenly, right at the start, as complex. They were advanced just as if they were planted there without evolutionary history, as we've seen. There were land plants, 60 genera, 60 different genera of land plants. This is one of the categories of biology. Below, of course, the Chordata, that is the phylum. If you look in the geology textbooks, the Cambrian is supposed to be all shallow seas everywhere. No land anywhere. But if you have 60 genera of land plants represented there, that picture doesn't work too well, does it? You have six groups of vascular plants described as advanced. Vascular plants are those like trees. If you got trees, six groups of trees, I believe you got some land somewhere. Not the way the geology books describe the Cambrian. All the major anatomical designs, the Chordata, all of its major divisions. We have vertebrates documented in the articles in the handout from Wyoming, Oklahoma, Washington, Nevada, Idaho, Arkansas. And that article documenting that goes all the way back to 1989. Now, they've known about that for a long time, and how many geology books or earth science books tell you that you have vertebrates right down at the bottom of the geologic column? I'll just challenge you to find any. But they've known it for a long time, and it's been published in the journals. And since that Cambrian explosion, there have been no new major divisions, no new phyla. Now, what does that look like? Doesn't look like evolution, does it? And again, this is not me describing this. It might sound like me. You might imagine that's what I would say. But I'm not the one saying that. These are the leading evolutionists. The antagonistic witnesses are the ones saying this. But you look in the textbook, and how is the record of life represented? Well, you begin with this single-celled organism, and then it gradually develops upward to the animals with backbones up at the top. And then it gets branched out, so you have all the different types. If you just turn that thing upside down, it looks a whole lot more like the fossil record. Because you've got all of the major types, actually more than you have now, and we've lost some, right at the beginning. Notice again from Stephen Gould of Harvard. He says, "The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches." Now, the real information is out here. This branching, connecting business is something we've drawn. He says, "The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of the fossils." Now, you see these evolutionary trees in the textbooks. Don't think that comes from the fossil record. That's in spite of the fossil record. It's virtually upside down of what the fossil record is, as even Gould acknowledges. He says, "The sweep of anatomical diversity," and he'll use some big words here, but basically all the anatomy that is different, the greatest amount of difference is seen right at the start, reached a maximum right after the initial diversification of multicellular animals. Now, he didn't see this diversification happen because when it started, it was already done, but he believes it. That's just a matter of faith. But the greatest diversity is not up at the top, it's right down at the bottom. The later history of life proceeded by elimination, not expansion. Now, the evolutionist would say it ought to be expanding. No, it started with the greatest diversity and went downhill. This is just the opposite, exactly the opposite of what the evolutionist would predict. In fact, in this book, Wonderful Life, Gould talks about the cone of diversity and says this is the way evolutionists have imagined that it would be. But when we look at the fossil record, he says it's really very, very different from that. It goes downhill. We went one too far there. Let's back up. It actually goes downhill and looks more like this. There were more at the start. It's gone downhill. We still have quite a few, but not as many as we used to have. That's not what the evolutionist would predict. This is what he predicts, and this is what he represents in the textbook. But that's not the fossil record. Well, now, where did they get this? How do they come up with this kind of a representation? Well, that's their faith. And it's in spite of the evidence. Notice the description in Evolution of the Earth by Dott and Patton, standard geology textbook. We have arranged the groups in a traditional way with the simplest forms first and progressively more complex groups followed. So how do you get these trees? Well, they arranged it that way. Not because of what they found in the fossil record, but in spite of it. Now, we don't want to misrepresent them or be unfair, but he does say this particular arrangement is arbitrary and depends on which definition of complexity you wish to choose. But he does have a fundamental principle by which he arranges this. He says arbitrary, but he's a little too far sounding like he's on my side. What he's talking about, he goes on to say later on the same page. He says things are alike because they're related. And it's on this basis that he builds the tree. That's how he arranges it. Not completely, but at least that's one of the primary principles. The less they look alike, the further removed they are from their common ancestor. And so on this principle of similarities indicate kinship, he builds the column, totally apart from what he finds in the fossil record. The principle of similarities is something we need to deal with because that's really what makes the fossil record mean something. Otherwise, you've just got a bunch of dead things in rocks. How do you relate them? Well, it's on the basis of similarity. And we look at the fossils and we see the ape and we see the man and they're similar. Can anybody deny that? Now, you see dissimilarities, but let's just be honest. The similarities are, I think, much more dramatic and more striking and very obvious. The question, though, is why is that true? Some people assume, well, that means they must have evolved. They're similar. Without considering the fact, there may be some alternative explanations. Is there another way to explain similarity? Well, you drive down the street in the subdivision and you see houses that are similar because they're all cousins, right? Well, no, you had a common designer, a common architect. That's at least a possible explanation, is it not? Not because of common genetics, obviously, but because of common design. Now, when we look at the fossil record, that's I think at least a possible explanation. In fact, the closer we look, I think we see that's a much better explanation. Certainly we see similarities, and these are illustrated in the textbooks. You look at the vertebrate hand or arm and this pendactyl form, the five fingers we see with the frog and with the rabbit and with the lizard. We see with the bird. We see with some of the fish even. The similarity is obvious. Now, you can explain that by common genetics or by common designer. The question is, which one is the better explanation? And the fact of the matter is that you have a very, very difficult time explaining this by common genetics, though it's just asserted, usually without argument, in the biology textbooks. Why is it not by common genetics? Well, when you study the genetics, the genes, and the development from the embryo, what you find is that these hands, which are so similar, develop from different genes from different parts of the embryo. We see, for example, the newt develops from segments 2 through 5 in the embryo, the hand part does. In the man, the hand comes from segments 13 through 18. That's different genetics, a different part of the embryo. In the lizard, it's segments 6 through 9. It doesn't come from common genetics. Different genes, different parts of the embryo produce the hand. And so that argues against the idea that this similarity is because of common genetics. But when we look at similarities, these points are ignored, and they say, well, it's similar, it must be kin. And then they'll just argue, well, Dr. Patton, don't you know that cousins look similar? I mean, you see brothers and sisters, you can see similar. Yes, sometimes they're not, but many times they are, and that's an obvious possibility. And we know that's from common genetics. This, though, has some difficulties. But this is the real argument from the fossil record, similarities. And so we need to talk about that. And there are various forms of this argument from similarity, and some of them they don't use anymore, but or at least not as much as they did. They used to argue in this way from the chromosomes. And they say, look, we see the penicillium just has 2. The housefly has 12. Human has 46. And you see this evolutionary progression. When you look at the similarities of the chromosomes, you see an evolutionary picture. And they really, many of the textbooks don't use this anymore, but some of them do. And why did they quit? Well, they got more information. And sometimes, if you just pick out a little bit of information and just show the ones they want you to see, you can draw a picture that's very misleading. When you look at the rest of the information, you see, yes, the human has 46, but the chimp has 48. Tobacco has 48. The fern has 480. And sure enough, the penicillium has 2. But when you look at that whole picture, that doesn't look like an evolutionary progression, does it? The turkey has 82, and we have 46. Well, then maybe we better look somewhere else. But this is the argument from similarity. Some have suggested, and many of the textbooks will argue about the amount of DNA. I mean, after all, we're more complex. We ought to have more DNA, and we've evolved more. But when you compare the DNA of humans with, for example, the Euglenia, single-celled organisms, we've got almost exactly the same amount of DNA. When we look at the liverwort, this moss-like plant, it has 18 times as much DNA as the human does. And lo and behold, the salamander has 26 times as much. Well, maybe we better forget that argument. Many of you have heard the point that the genome of man, the DNA, is just almost identical with the ape. This similarity is just... And that's what we expect when we look at the ape and man, and of course they're overstating the case. But granting that that is the case, actually, the more specifically, they say 1.6% difference. Most of you have heard that, and if you've been in school lately, you've certainly heard that. And that sounds pretty similar. Okay, the DNA is so similar, we must be kin to them, is the conclusion. But it glosses over some very dramatic points. In the first place, 1.6% of the genome involves 48 million nucleotides. Now, these are the points of information on the DNA. 3 billion nucleotides in the genome, well, just 1.6% difference is a big difference. Well, how much difference does 48 million nucleotides make? Well, we compare humans who have cystic fibrosis to those who don't, and we see the difference is not 1.6%, but it's 1/1,000,000,000%. It's only 3 nucleotides. And this is relentlessly fatal. Sickle cell anemia, which likewise produces fatalities, involves 0.001%. That's only one nucleotide, and it kills people. But you're going to change 48 million randomly, and it doesn't really make any difference. We're just 1.6% difference. Well, you see, that's glossing over a huge difference here. And then we look at mice, and here's a statement here from the National Human Genome Research Institute from last year, September. Overall, mice and humans share virtually the same set of genes. The average protein coding regions in the mouse and human genomes are 85% identical. Some genes are 99% identical. But they don't talk about that because we're not supposed to come from the mice. We come from the ape. When you get all the rest of the facts together, things begin to look very different, don't they? Actually, the argument from similarity proves a whole lot more than they really want to be proved. We look at these two fish, and they look similar, don't they? If I got some heads nodding there, I caught you, because they're not fish. They look like fish. They're similar to fish. But the one on top is a reptile, the one on bottom is a mammal. Neither one of them are fish, though that's what they look like. They're not kin to fish. They're not kin to each other. But they're similar, and similar to fish. The old adage is that which proves too much proves nothing, isn't it? You look at the platypus. Now, you just have a real hard time figuring out who he's kin to. He lays eggs like a bird and has fur like a mammal. He has electric receptors like paddlefish do. He has claws like a mammal and gives milk through the skin in very similar to the mammals. Fangs like a snake and webbed feet like a duck. And, of course, a bill like a duck. In fact, when the first one was found and reported to Science Magazine back in the late 1700s, it was written up as a fraud. And they said somebody sewed a duck bill on a beaver. That's the way it was written up in Nature. And, of course, has a tail like a beaver. Who's he kin to? Well, he's kin to everybody. He has a common designer, I think. But the argument just goes way beyond what they would like for it to. And you get all of the evidence. Like, if you look at those chromosomes, just part of the evidence presents one picture, but you get the rest of the evidence, and now then it looks different. When you look at man's, quote, relatives in terms of the similarity, we're often pointed to the blood serum. Chimpanzees have very, very similar blood serum to humans. In fact, if the right antiserum is used, you can actually interchange that with humans. Very similar. However, if you look at milk chemistry, that's not the case with chimpanzees. It is with the donkey. Well, not that similar, but the donkey milk is much closer to human milk than is the chimpanzee milk. In terms of cholesterol, which everybody's concerned about today, lo and behold, the garter snake has cholesterol just like we do, not the apes. And in terms of foot structure, which we're interested in when we look at the footprints down at Glen Rose, maybe something, what else might have done that? Some said maybe an ape. Well, of course, that wouldn't help the evolutionary picture much. But an ape has a hand for a foot. Easily distinguished from man, but the glacial bear has a foot very, very similar to humans. Now, it's a mirror image. The thumbs are on the outside, and of course, it has claws, and it's a quadruped, 4 feet. But you skin the thing, take the claws off, and put it in the mirror, and it looks so much like a human foot, it just is mind-boggling. Not the ape's foot. In terms of tear enzyme, the lysosome is in our eyes to fight bacteria. And it goes around like little Pac-Man, just eating up the bacteria, which we need. And the chicken needs that in the egg. And that's what you find. And what we're looking at here is not branching pattern and similarities, but the mosaic pattern, where the designer would use a blue tile here and a blue tile there and a mosaic. Here we see the chicken needs the lysosome in the egg. We need it in the eye. And this is not this branching pattern of similarities the evolutionists would predict, but exactly what we would predict with a mosaic designer, if you please. In terms of blood antigen A, lo and behold, our closest relative is the butterbean. And in terms of a brain hormone, Let's notice the article from Discover Magazine. Don't squash that roach. He may be your cousin. A cockroach and man, it seems, share a, not similar, a common brain hormone. Here's that mosaic pattern. Yes, similarities, but not the kind of similarities the evolutionist is predicting. They don't come from common genetics, and they don't form the branching pattern. They are exactly the kind of similarities that the creationist would predict. And if you're allowed to just pick and choose whichever ones you want, leave out the others. Let's not look at the reptile that looks similar to the fish. Let's just look at the fish. You can paint any kind of picture you want. This point was made back in Darwin's time by a cartoon, somewhat ridiculing it. But they saw the point immediately. All right, you say you can line things up and prove common descent. Let's look at the pig here. You just change that pig a little bit. And as you change it a little bit, you see him leading to the bull. And the bull changed just a little bit, just continues right on down. And obviously the pig evolved into a man by way of the bull. Obviously. See, you've proved it scientifically. Have you proved anything? Now, a lot of people see these lineups in the textbook and they say, wow, it's proved. There it is. Well, you're not proving anything except that somebody lined it up that way. That's not proof of anything. When we look at the fossil record, that is the evidence. If you're going to prove evolution, this is where it's at. This is critical, and especially at the beginning, but it's complex and abrupt and diverse. All of the major divisions in biology, all of the phyla are there, and they're none new since. The trees of life in the textbook are selected similarities. They're not from the fossils. They are in spite of the fossils. They're not from embryology or genetics. They're not common. When we look at similarities, we see a mosaic pattern, not a branching pattern. Now, that's the picture that we see when we look certainly at the beginning of the fossil record. But now, what about transitional forms? How would you see evolution in the fossil record? If you see this changing to this changing, you'd see transitions in between. It'd be necessary if you're going to demonstrate evolution. And, of course, if you're going to prove evolution, you have to have the fossil. Well, this is necessary. Notice what Darwin said about it in Origin of the Species. He says, innumerable transitional forms must have existed. That had to be if you're going to believe in evolution. But why do we not find them embedded in the countless numbers in the crust of the earth? He knew they weren't there. They're separate and distinct in the fossil record. Why no transitional forms? Why is not every geological formation, every stratum full of such intermediate links? He says geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain. And this perhaps is the greatest objection which can be urged against my theory. Now, a lot of people think Darwin was convinced by the fossil record. Now, he was convinced in spite of it and understood the fossil record was the biggest problem he had. And that's a fact. And I think it's the biggest problem the evolutionists have today as well. That's why I like to talk about the fossils. But he says this is the greatest objection that can be urged against my theory. I was making a presentation like this at Texas A&M and got to this point, and one of the professors just rudely stood up and shouted, "Interrupt! Why?" That was true in Darwin's day, but we filled in those gaps, and that's no longer the case. And I said, well, it's interesting that someone who's not quite a full professor yet would say that here at Texas A&M. Let's see what David Rapp says about that, who's curator of the largest fossil museum in the United States, the Chicago Field Museum of Natural History. He says Darwin was completely aware of this, that is, the fact that the gaps were there. He was embarrassed by the fossil record because it didn't look the way he predicted it would. Okay, what's happened since then? Well, we're now about 120 years after Darwin, and knowledge of the fossil record has been greatly expanded. Now we have 250,000 fossil species, but the situation hasn't changed much. He says, ironically, we have even fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we had in Darwin's time. It was the greatest embarrassment he had, and it's gotten worse. and she just kind of sunk down, and we didn't hear from her for a while. This fellow knows more about it than you'd be reasonable to conclude anybody in the country. He's a curator of the largest fossil museum that we have. And he's certainly an evolutionist and not on our side. However, we look in the textbook and we see what appears to be transitions as the little horse leads up to the big horse. It's not changing to something else, but nevertheless, that looks like a transition, doesn't it? Of course, when we put that 9-foot donkey in there that we talked about the other night, that kind of messes up the picture. But they don't do that. They leave him out. Notice what Colin Patterson says about this picture. And Colin Patterson recently passed away, but was at this time curator of the largest fossil museum in the world, the British Museum of Natural History. He said there have been an awful lot of stories, some more imaginative than others, and he's being interviewed. Actually, he's in America at the Natural History Museum in Chicago when he's being interviewed by Harper's reporter here. The most famous example is still on exhibit downstairs on horse evolution, prepared perhaps 50 years ago, that has been presented as the literal truth in textbook after textbook. Anybody here ever seen that? It's in all the textbooks. I think that is lamentable. Particularly when the people who propose those kinds of stories may themselves be aware of the speculative nature of some of that stuff. He looks at that and he wants to cry. Because he knows this is not what you see in the fossil record. This is speculative. George Gaylord Simpson is the one from Harvard who actually came up with this story 50 years ago. And that's he's the one who originated the horse picture. He's writing in his book Life of the Past and says the uniform continuous transformation of Hydrocotherium into Equius, that's the little one up to the big one, so dear to the hearts of generations of textbook writers, never happened in nature. It's in the textbooks, but it never happened. Now, he believes in evolution, but it didn't happen the way they got it in the textbooks. It went this way and that way, and it's a big, bushy-looking, disordered. Very different from the neat picture the textbooks display. Derek Ager, when this was written, was president of the British Geological Association. He says, it must be significant that nearly all the evolutionary stories I learned as a student have now been debunked. And he's talking in the context about the horse story. That's one of the stories that has been debunked, and he mentioned several others. Nearly all of them were stories I was taught, and it's we know better now. And of course, they tell you that in the textbooks, don't they? But the president of the British Geological Association acknowledges that in print, in the Proceedings of the Geological Association. He will say there are still some transitional forms. There ought to be millions. He mentions one. And that's Archaeopteryx. That's the one perhaps most often mentioned. This is the half-reptile, half-bird that is the transition between the reptiles and the birds. Now, the restored form here looks very, very bird-like. This is the fossil that was found, the Berlin fossil. When you look at the feathers of it, it had beautiful feathers, and they're asymmetrical, indicating a flying bird, not the symmetrical type with a vein down the middle and non-flying. When you look at the wing, it looks just exactly like a powered flyer, a good bird wing. But we're told, look up at the leading edge. It's got claws, and that means it's primitive. Well, it's got something the others don't have. Others have lost that. But many, or at least a number, of good modern birds have claws on their wings. One of the more obvious is the Hoatzin down in South America, which is a 100% real good bird, and it's got claws just like that. So what is proved? But look at Archaeopteryx. It's got teeth. The bird has teeth, and so it must be primitive. I've got teeth. What does this prove? When you look throughout the animal kingdom, you see some amphibians have teeth and some don't. And some reptiles have teeth and some don't. Some birds have teeth and some don't. Maybe some of you have teeth and some don't. What are we proving here? I mean, actually, the tern in the fossil record, which is one of the best-powered flyers in the world, travels over 3,000 miles in its migration, had teeth and it lost them. This is kind of like the picture of that salamander that went blind that we talked about the other night. It's going downhill. It lost something that it had. And there are modern birds that have teeth. Many of you perhaps are unfamiliar with it, but here's the gray-legged goose who has excellent teeth. Some of the hummingbirds have teeth. Many of them have lost their teeth. But the real knockout punch when it comes to the bird evolution is the fact that the birds got there before these things that are supposed to have led to them. In nature, back in 86, not in the textbooks yet, but reported in Nature, here's the fossil remains claim to be of two crow-sized birds 75 million years older than Archaeopteryx. Now, Archaeopteryx is supposed to be leading to the birds. But here are two birds that are half again as old as what's supposed to have led to them. Paleontologist at Texas Tech, and this is an associate, one whom I've worked with several times, found the fossil, says they have advanced avian or advanced bird features. This is a perfectly modern, advanced bird that's half again as old as what it's supposed to have led to. Now, it's very difficult to imagine a scenario where you've got the kids older than the parents, but this is the kind of picture, the kind of contradiction that they run into. W. Swenson, in his book Comparative Physiology of Birds, Biology and Comparative Physiology, is at Cambridge University, and just tells it like it is. He says, the origin of birds is largely a matter of deduction. There is no fossil evidence of the stages through which the remarkable change from reptile to birds was achieved. Zip. Zero. Now, how do you get to be a bird from a reptile? Well, you got to have hollow bones. You have a totally different circulatory system, different heart, a totally different respiratory system. They breathe in. They don't turn around and breathe back out. They come in and then it goes out their arms. It's a much more efficient system, and they need that to be flying. What would it take to change us to get us up and flying? I mean, it'd take quite a revolution. But not one step is recorded in the fossil record. No fossil evidence of this remarkable change. Zip. Which is, of course, exactly what we would predict. D.P. Kitts of University of Oklahoma, writing in the journal Evolution, describes, and we're jumping ahead here, we looked at the most commonly used link, intermediate, that's referred to, and it falls flat. And that's the case with all of them. D.B. Kitts summarizes when he says, evolution requires intermediate forms between the species, and paleontology, study of the fossils, does not provide them. Now, he has great faith and believes in evolution. He's writing in the journal, but he's acknowledging they're not there. It's worse than it was in Darwin's day. The fact that discontinuities, now continuities would show leading from one to the other, but gaps are expressed here with discontinuity. The fact that discontinuities are almost always and systematically present. Now, if you just need to sample a few more and they'll be filled up, you'd find random gaps here and there. But that's not the way it is. They're systematically present at the origin of really big category. If you've got what's really a different kind, you've got a gap. Every time. Systematically. This is an item of genuinely historical knowledge. Now, this is one of the leading authorities on evolution who believes in it devoutly. But discontinuities are systematic at anything really different, and we know that, is what he's acknowledged. S.M. Stanley from Johns Hopkins says, in fact, the fossil record does not convincingly document a single transition from one species to another. There ought to be millions, as Darwin acknowledged. He said, this is the biggest problem I've got. It's gotten much, much worse as we have clearly defined and studied the fossil record. Not one. And this is one of the leading proponents of evolution. A.C. Stewart of Cambridge says the theoretically primitive type eludes our grasp. We ought to see primitive types leading to the more advanced types. We look for it, we can't find it. Our faith postulates its existence, but the type fails to materialize. Someone said for the evolutionist, this faith is the substance of fossils hoped for, the evidence of links unseen. But it's a blind faith that postulates but does not see evidence. And so when we summarize the evidence, in the words of the evolutionist, it delights the creationist, it embarrasses the evolutionist by their own acknowledgement. It was Darwin's biggest problem, then it is worse now. The links have been debunked one after another by the evolutionist, and their faith believes evolution, but the evidence is not there. I think the conclusion inevitably follows that the fossil record favors creation. It shouts, it speaks very eloquently, but it doesn't speak for the evolutionist. All right, we went longer than normal. We'll have a shorter second part, but let's see if some of you have some questions. Yes, sir. Oh, yes. In fact, they're probably the most important when you're looking for oil. The little foraminifera, many of which are microscopic, are what you look for to help identify the layers. And you virtually can't find a sedimentary rock. In fact, you have to get in the Precambrian, which are pretty rare, without finding some kind of fossil. Now, you may not recognize it, but I can show it to you. Certainly, if you've got a magnifying glass. The rocks are full of them. We're living on a graveyard. Yes. Now, below the Cambrian, you find some of this blue-green algae and some of the bacteria, but not a whole lot of it. I think it's exactly what we would predict in the ground before the flood, and then the flood deposit piles on top of that, and that's where you got the explosion. Virtually nothing, and then all of it. Yes. If that geologic column that we talked about last night, and I think showed does not fit the facts, represents reality, and some of our brethren have compared that with the days of creation, which is, I think, I don't know how they can do it honestly, but because it's dramatically different. But if this is true, we need to realize that Cambrian layer is defined because it has peculiar fossils. They're fossils that are peculiar to the Cambrian. They're different from the ones in the Silurian that come after it, and then different from the ones in the Ordovician that come after that. If this is different from that, and this is millions of years afterwards, what does it look like? It looks like it changed over time, doesn't it? And this one is still different because it's millions of years later. And then more millions, we've got something still different. You have changed through time. I'm sorry. If that's reality, you've given away the store. There's no way to escape change through time, which is what evolution is, if that's real. Now, it is true. They're different. Cambrian is different from that. I don't think it's because time transpired. I think it represents one catastrophic year-long series of events, and what you have at the bottom of the ocean is different from what lived higher, and what lived in the swamps is different from what lived on the plains, and they're segregated, not all together in one place, but you have groups that lived in the swamp and groups that lived at the bottom of the ocean, just like you do today, and the flood buried them where they lived. So it was all contemporary. They were different, not because they were millions of years apart, but because they lived in different places and got buried there. I can explain the difference. When you explain it in terms of millions of years, I think you have given up the store in trying to fight evolution, and some of our brethren need to realize that. Other questions? Yes. We have very similar structures in the reptiles that act like birds. We have similar structures with the mammals that act like birds, with the bats, and then similar in the birds themselves. They're not kin to each other, but they're very, very similar. And sometimes that dramatic difference in totally different groups, dramatic similarity in totally different groups is just overwhelming. You look at the marsupial wolf and look at his skull. I just challenge you to tell the difference between that and the placentia wolf. Now, they reproduce totally differently. They're not kin. One's a marsupial and one's a placentia. But they are... Well, you can't tell the difference. If you're just looking at the skull, sorry, it's the same. No matter what angle you come at it. Maybe a grad student who's been working for years with them can see the difference, but you and I couldn't see it. Similarities do not prove common descent or similar genetics. Yes. The flood. How many of you have ever seen a universal flood? Obviously, we haven't seen that, and so we don't really know everything. We know some, but very little, about what a universal flood would be about from local floods. The difference is more than we imagine. Water transports sediment, and faster-moving water transports more sediment, right? And if you have a really catastrophic movement, then you transport a lot. How much difference is you double the speed of the water and you increase the sediment transport capability by a factor of 12 just by doubling the speed. Now, when you really increase it a whole lot more than doubling it like you would in a universal flood, you just do things you can't imagine. We've done computer models. We have very general, vague ideas. I think it fits very closely what we see, but we have to admit there's a whole lot we don't know. It does more than... I think it eroded the surface of the earth to a depth of over a mile and then redeposited it, and we're living on that graveyard with billions and billions of dead things and rocks laid down by water all over the world. Average of about a mile and a half of sedimentary rock underneath us, covering the continents. I think that says judgment. Much more than it says evolution. Yes, sir. As we pointed out Monday night, with enough secondary and tertiary quaternary assumptions, you can make any model fit. But with evolution, you have to assume this, and that works except here, and then you assume that. And with all these assumptions, you can make... But with the creation model, it's exactly what we predict right from the start. And when you look at the contrasting predictions of each and you see which one fits perfectly and which one does not, an honest person ought to be impressed. All right, we thank you very much for your questions. Let's take a 5-minute break, and then I think we can wrap up on schedule. We'll do a little monkeying around in the second part as we talk about fossil man.